My name is Jessica Anthony, and my novel is called The Most.
Jessica Anthony's novel, The Most, takes place on a single, unseasonably hot day in November 1957. When Kathleen Beckett refuses to get out of the pool at her apartment complex, her husband Virgil grows increasingly anxious. Through memory and perspective, Anthony explores the years of marriage leading up to this pivotal moment when neither reader nor character knows what's in store for the two. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goulet, and here's my conversation with Jessica Anthony. So can you start by giving our listeners a description of the book? Who are Kathleen and Virgil Beckett?
Kathleen and Virgil are a married couple in 1957 who are finding themselves on a very warm day, an unusually warm day in Delaware, about to begin what is a life-changing 8 hours in their marriage. The novel opens with Kathleen feeling a little unwell, feeling a little off, and she decides not to go to church with her husband and the boys. And instead, after they leave, she decides she feels like a swim. And so she takes a dip in the community swimming pool and then somehow decides she doesn't really want to leave that swimming pool. She wants to stay there. Yeah, so that's what the novel is about.
So let's talk about the timeline. The Most is told over the course of one Sunday, as you mentioned. It's that exceptionally hot day in November 1957, but it's also told through memory. And it also in the background is the launch of Sputnik 2. Why this time and place for the story?
It's a great question. I am very interested in women who were writing in the 1950s. I love to read the fiction and the poetry and the plays of that time period. And I thought it might be an interesting opportunity to walk into my own understanding of the cliche of the 1950s housewife and see what surprises might be waiting for me there as a novelist. I was very surprised to feel as I was writing this novel, the degree to which Kathleen Beckett and other women in the time period in the book really weren't that different from us here in 2024. And so as Kathleen is moving through her day, staying in the pool, we're hearing quite a bit about how she came into this marriage, who her parents were. We learn a great deal about her history as a tennis champion in college. She had all kinds of opportunity that ended up sort of falling to the wayside as she elected instead to enter into this relationship with Virgil Beckett and move down to Rhode Island. And so there's something I think that's, I guess, universal about, in particular, a certain kind of female experience where, you know, we are just sometimes given opportunity in our lives that doesn't make sense for us in a particular moment in time. And so we decide, you know, we take a different path. And in some ways, we're not always as well equipped as we could be in that moment to make what may have been a better decision for ourselves. And Kathleen is no exception. She is in many ways a rebel, but she is not rebelling against the patriarchy. She's not rebelling against the forces around her that are very much keeping her in her place. She's sort of figuring out what it is she really wants and who she really is. You know, she's doing the work that we all do, you know, now. So in a way, even though 70 years are between us, I find myself feeling a lot of commonality with this character who, like myself, has been married for a while and, you know, asks herself questions about what it is to be married, what it is to be part of a partnership. And so maybe some things don't change all that much.
I want to talk about the women you were reading, the writers you were reading, because this had the tension and slow burn of a classic short story to me, or perhaps two short stories braided together. And I can't put my finger on exactly who it reminded me of, maybe Flannery O'Connor or Raymond Carver. Mm. And I don't know if it's because it was, you know, they were writing of a different time as well. So who are the authors who influenced your writing?
Yeah, well, first, let me just say that I was very much interested in trying to capture that particular sound of a 50s narrative. So I wanted the novel to feel, and we could call it a novella. I wanted it to feel almost like an undiscovered or previously unknown work of literature from that time period. Like, oh, how did this get lost, you know? And so that was a very deliberate choice and challenge to try to capture that sound. But I was reading quite a bit of Flannery O'Connor, quite a bit of Shirley Jackson, Patricia Highsmith. There's a wonderful playwright, Alice Childress, who many folks don't know, but she was positioned to be the first African-American woman to, or frankly, first African-American to have their work produced on Broadway. She wrote a wonderful play called Trouble in Mind. And then the white producers on Broadway wanted her to change her ending to make it more palatable for audiences, and she refused to do so. So her play was not produced, and A Raisin in the Sun was the first play that appeared on Broadway. So Carson McCullers is another great example. Grace Paley's first novel came out in 1959. So, you know, I'm looking at a number of extraordinarily powerful, interesting, complicated female protagonists that were being written in this time period. And I just started getting curious about the kind of commonalities between them. You often would see characters who are in landscapes that feel almost surreal in their grotesquerie. The challenges and the conflicts that surround them are often kind of inflated and grotesque. And so it just seemed to me that there's almost like a movement going on that many people aren't aware of in writing, that there actually was quite a bit of sort of feminist and social justice writing happening in this time period, way before the 60s, which everyone understands generally to be, you know, this great transformative social decade for us in the States. But a lot of that was actually happening earlier, you know, and so I started getting interested in who is this woman who is not able to change the water that she's in, right? If I'm going to go there. So like, where do you go if you can't fight the water that you're in? You have to work from within. And from that angle, I began to discover her unique singularity. And then I started really getting interested in this character.
So let's talk about these characters you created, because first, you know, we learn that on the day that these two meet, Kathleen and Virgil, Kathleen calls Virgil a faker in regards to, you know, a foot or leg injury. And he feels like she sees through him. And that's a refrain that we, you know, it continues throughout the marriage. Talk to me about Kathleen as an observer.
Well, I mean, I think to watch and observe is it's a lost art, isn't it? I mean, we spend so much time staring at our phones these days, and we're missing out on a heck of a lot. Kathleen is watching because that's all she can do, right? I mean, she's interested in the way that Virgil dresses himself and what that says about her. She's interested in, you know, the other old folks who live in the other levels of the apartment complex where they're living in Newark, Delaware, because that's what one does when one doesn't have an iPhone. One watches other people. And I think in some ways her character is really well designed and positioned in her sort of bitterness and antipathy towards the classic female 50s housewife trope to give us some reports about her husband, about her landlord, about her friends who end up being fairly monstrous figures by the end of the novella. And so I liked Kathleen's sort of grounded pragmatism. I liked her sense that she was going to be able to communicate to me, a woman in the, you know, in the 21st century, the same things that I might see if I am sitting out, out on my stoop here in Portland, Maine, watching people go by. It's not always with a kind eye that we are observing, I should say. So,
I guess everybody was observing her as well. Nobody had the phones. Okay, but then there's Virgil. He had a prettiness about him, and there was a quote, "Whatever poor woman agreed to marry him would suffer a lifetime of feeling less than." What should we know about Virgil?
Oh, I mean, what I want from Virgil is for him to know himself. I mean, Virgil is a type, I should say, of a man who has been just blessed, you know, in many ways. He has never really had to make his own decisions about how to take care of himself or fulfill his needs, that all of that has been done for him by his sisters. And his beauty has really been an active kind of currency in his life. He has known how to spend it. And even when he's overseas, purportedly at war, he lands in a place that has no conflict and kind of lucks out of not being shipped off to France. And so, you know, he just is sort of sliding around problems and conflict for his entire life, which enables him to slide right into what is, on the page at least, I would say the wrong marriage, like the wrong person for him. But he can't help but be drawn to Kathleen's ability to make decisions, to get things done. It means that he won't have to. So, in a way, maybe what we need to learn about Virgil is that his laziness overrides all else.
I want to go back and touch on, something we were talking about, how, we're learning part of the story through memory. How reliable is memory, especially when honesty, honesty between characters, honesty with themselves, is suspect?
Oh, I mean, memory is a filter and it's hugely unreliable. Now, the point of view of the novella is actually it's a kind of omniscience that hews more closely to one perspective, you know, and then the next. But there is an omniscient narrator who is offering us what we can assume to be a fair report. That being said, that narrator is selecting to leave an awful lot out. And so the historical anecdotes that we get about these two characters are, they principally relate to the present moment conflict of Kathleen being in the pool. We have to learn about, you know, how she was elbow deep in muck in the basement of her first home in Rhode Island, kind of fighting to get the house together in order to understand what it means for her to be in the swimming pool today on November 3rd in 1957. So I would just say like a writerly choice is to be very alert to what episodes or stories from a character's past really create that essential context for understanding the character's present moment condition.
Let's jump back in that pool because Kathleen does not want to get out of the apartment swimming pool. And you mentioned earlier, she was swimming in different waters. Talk to me about the importance of this vessel. Is there a special meaning for the pool?
You know, in full disclosure, the swimming pool emerged as an idea a long time ago. I mean, way back like 15 years ago, I read some crazy article about a naked man who refused to get out of his pool, and everyone was kind of rallying to try to get him out of the pool. And I just thought that was a really absurd and sort of funny thing that, you know, that might make its way into a story one day. But then when I sat down to write the most, and I began only with Kathleen not feeling well. I never make a plan for my fiction. It occurred to me that maybe she needed to just cool off. And where does one go to cool off? One goes to a little pool. And so, in this apartment building, this old sort of rundown Acropolis place, Greek-owned apartment building. She finds her way into the swimming pool and suddenly feels a lot better. So why would you leave a place that's making you feel better? And so there's no overt symbolic import that I can share with you because I just don't write that way, but I can say that Kathleen is a human woman in 1957 who felt like a swim, and it felt so good she just wanted to keep swimming until she realized what her subconscious was doing, like why it was important for her to keep swimming on this day.
I did find it curious that she was the only person to swim in that pool because it was shut down for so long.
Oh, there are reasons.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that.
There are reasons.
I'd like to talk a bit about the title, The Most. One of your characters, Billy, described a certain tennis move and called it The Most. Talk to me about that move and how Kathleen brought that move into her marriage.
Yeah. So Kathleen in high school met Billy Blasko, who is Slovakian, Czechoslovakian, and he had escaped World War II and made it to the United States and was enrolled at UD, University of Delaware. And he is teaching her tennis lessons. And, you know, they end up falling in love and he, you know, sleeps with her and starts this grand romance. And then he goes off to college at the end of the summer, and she is left to finish high school and begin her own college career with Billy Blasko very much on her mind. But the story of the most, this word most in Czech and Slovak means bridge. And so we learn that Billy's father was a famous Czechoslovakian tennis pro, which is how he knows how to teach Kathleen tennis. And he has this maneuver called the most, which wins him all the matches. He goes to the Olympic Games in London and he's winning. And so Kathleen fundamentally is a very competitive personality. So when the time comes for her to face off at the end of the novel with her, as she sees it, her most important competitor, which is her husband, Virgil, she's going to use what she knows, which is the move she's been taught. But she's going to exercise this move in a very unusual way. And that's all I can really say about it.
Okay, so let's talk about perspective because we learn this story through shifts between Kathleen and Virgil in the present and then reflecting on their past. But instead of taking over where the other left off, we see the same events repeated, but through a complete shift in perspective. So, talk to me about seeing the same events through two different lenses. And was one voice clearer for you than the other when writing it, or did tapping into each of them come easily for you?
Oh, that's such a great question. Thanks for that. I love the structure of this book, and I did not anticipate that this would be the structure, but it just felt like the appropriate way to get at what I was really interested in this marriage, which is the different ways that two people can see your average ordinary day. And there was actually, I should say, a great deal more repetition before my editor got involved. So, you know, I calmed down and pared down some of the repetition, but I think there's nothing more sort of delicious than an opportunity to re-see a fact in fiction. Objects and scenes even can be completely recontextualized and new meaning can emerge in a really interesting sideways way that stands to delight even me, you know, the writer. And so I've never written a structure like this before, and I found it so exciting and so invigorating. And there is a moment as we move through the book where the timeline forcibly collides, and we get almost the exact same scene written in the exact same language between the two characters, which, you know, had to be very carefully executed because you go too heavy and the reader is just going to feel like you are taking up space. And so I spent a lot of time working on that kind of climactic moment where we get a repetition of perspective. But I so delighted in sort of reveling in the repetition of the banal in this fiction, because objects really do create a landscape, and the landscape is where the life lives. And so even though the reader may feel like, oh, I already learned that information, but they may have learned that information in a very kind of prejudicial way from, say, Virgil's perspective, and then Kathleen is translating it just slightly differently sometimes, and sometimes dramatically differently. So I think the texture of the unevenness of the view was really interesting. And it speaks to your earlier question too, Beth, about the untenable nature of memory itself. This is such a good example of why memory is essentially filter. It's the filter of what we can recall, what we've been told we can recall, and it's hugely unreliable. And so are the most basic events of our days, because our view of how we've lived our day may be wildly different from our partner's understanding of the day. And I find that to be just like a riveting place to travel into in fiction, because that's what fiction is here for. I mean, that's what interiority can do, and no other medium can do it.
I want to avoid spoilers, but initially, Kathleen and Virgil seem like opposites, but they're really not so different from each other, are they?
No, they are not. They are, I think Kathleen's friend Patricia once called them fruit from the same bowl. Yeah, they're both stunted in their own ways, but they share the enjoyment of not really being in like a marriage or a partnership that is honest. They both actually are fine with that for 9 years. So I think it takes a unique personality to be able to do that. And they share it. They share that personality.
Okay, I know I'm not supposed to get background from Wikipedia, but I saw that in addition to writing, you've held a series of diverse occupations across the globe, ranging from a butcher in Sitka, Alaska, an unlicensed masseuse in Poland, and a secretary in San Francisco. What called you to each of these jobs, and do any still hold a place in your heart?
Oh, I love this question. Yeah, I mean, I was like a singing telegram gal for one summer. I don't know. I had something like 25 jobs before the age of 27. I was very good at quitting things. but I think I was just interested in learning about the world and whatever opportunity I could, you know, take to sort of study people and as we were talking about watching earlier, I think just to kind of watch people go about their day. And so, you know, you learn, I think, a heck of a lot more as a writer working as a clerk in a convenience store in Alaska than you do necessarily, you know, in a classroom somewhere, especially if you are a novelist, if you're interested in character. You've got to go out, especially when you're young, and, you know, expose yourself to all different kinds of people and see what unites us and what divides us. And I also, I think, just have that sort of drive for a little bit of fun. You know, I mean, I like to move around a lot. I haven't been able to, like, all through COVID, I couldn't really go anywhere or do anything. So it's just sort of my personality to, I think, experiment with different ways of living and being. And I would urge any burgeoning writers listening to our program to go out and take that job that is completely strange to your experience and see what it can teach you about how people are. People are so interesting, and we're forgetting that right now, you know. We're forgetting how interesting we can be and how different we can be from one another. I mean, the internet is such a homogenized space. We're all using the same language. We're all creating the same kind of videos and little entertainment treats for each other, but that's not really, of course, how we are in life. And so the performance of the thing is never going to be as interesting as the thing itself. So I would urge writers to not forget that and go chase it. It's a wicked lot of fun. I'm in Maine, so I can say wicked. It's a lot of wicked fun.
Okay, so the book, I'm going to read the dedication. To my family and the bridge guards. What are bridge guards?
So in 2017, I was given the opportunity to go serve as a metaphorical bridge guard in a tiny little village in Štúrovo, Slovakia, for 3 months. And my job was to go and guard this bridge, the Maria Valeria Bridge, crossing from Štúrovo, Slovakia into Esztergom, Hungary, through the act of writing. So the story is the bridge was destroyed in World War I and it was rebuilt, and then the Nazis bombed it and it remained unbuilt for 60 years. And then in 2001, they finally rebuilt the bridge and they created a program to have photographers, painters, writers there in residence to guard the bridge against further fascism through the act of creation. So our presence there keeps the bridge intact. And so the novel very much was a response to this specific charge that I had as the 41st bridge guard. You're there by yourself to guard this bridge. I wrote the first draft of The Most, which of course means bridge. And every day I would get up, I would walk across the bridge and back again. It's about a 500 meter bridge. Sometimes I would bike and I would sort of, say hello to the bridge every morning. I would come home, I would write reports in this giant leather-bound bridge log, where we had to, dictate the small events of our days guarding the bridge. And then I would sit down and I would work on The Most. And I was living right across the under the bridge, but right across the street was a Slovakian rock club that only played heavy metal. And not only that, they only ever played Metallica. And not only that, they only ever played Enter Sandman or whatever it's called. So every, I don't know, 8 p.m. every weekend night, you would hear the notes, like that song would begin. And it became a part of the repetition of my experience of guarding the bridge was to listen to a Slovakian performance of Enter Sandman by Metallica. So it was great. It was an amazing summer. And I also had worked on my previous novel, Enter the Aardvark, there as well. So it was a productive and really, really fun experience.
What is next for you?
Excellent question. I recently spent a month in residence as a fellow at the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington. And that is all I will tell you.
So, do you have a hope for readers of this book? Anything that you would like for them to take away?
That's a really interesting question. I think my hope would be that a reader would approach the novel as open-minded as they could and be willing to, I don't know, be willing to travel into a kind of narrative storytelling that is maybe a little bit unconventional, and to view the novel as like an experience and not merely a story, but something to be felt. That would be my hope. That maybe is a grand ambition. I don't know. But I mean, I want readers fundamentally to just, enjoy the fiction. It's a short novel. It takes almost no time to read, and there's a very specific reason why. Just like Kathleen is waiting in her pool, I'm hoping readers just drop in. You get used to the water and you just want to stay there. That's my goal.
The book is The Most. Jessica Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jessica Anthony, author of the book The Most, which was published by Little Brown. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.